Hello, everyone. It's your old friend Will here. My co-host Luke is away for this episode and will be returning later this week. So in the meantime, I'm pleased to present you another in our ongoing semi-regular series of solo documentary episodes. Of course, it's been a notable couple days in American politics. I'm sure you're all interested in our takes on issues such as Joe Biden withdrawing from the presidential race, Kamala Harris becoming the heir apparent, etc. I'm sure we'll address these and other topics later this week, but in the meantime, I'll just say, I have no opinions on American politics. I'm from Canada. In the meantime, I'd like to take you on a tour through the history of one of my favorite cinematic subgenres, the Mondo movie. Loyal listeners will recall that in episode 396, we discussed the pioneering example of this genre, 1962's Mondo Cane, a shockumentary about bizarre rituals from around the world. As you all remember, Luke fell instantly in love with this movie.
This film, honestly, I could not think of another example of a film we've talked about on this podcast or watched that emanates the particular kind of pretension that this movie has. It is just radiating this kind of smug insistence on its own self-importance when really it is the same stupid conceit repeated over and over again, and which is alternatively used to show you images that are disgusting and disturbing, or which are just kind of like extremely softcore stuff that would have been, yeah, titillating in like 1963.
Boy, those were the days. While it's little seen, discussed, or admired today, Mondo Cane sent shockwaves in the 1960s, becoming the most commercially successful documentary of its time and codifying the shockumentary form for generations. Today, the influence of the Mondo boom can still be felt. If you've seen Mondo Cane, you may be wondering, why would anybody go back for more? But believe it or not, they did. For years.
More than the greatest love the world has known.
But just as Night of the Living Dead codified but didn't exactly invent the zombie genre, there are many precedents for the shockumentary before Mondo Cane. In the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, Hollywood studios were bound by a self-enforced censorship code, which strictly forbade certain subjects, including illegal traffic in drugs, white slavery, sex hygiene and venereal disease, and scenes of actual childbirth. The code was accepted by all major studios and most movie theaters on the grounds that its enforcement would save everyone the hassle of battling with local censor boards. The forbidden subjects thus became the exclusive terrain of independent producers and theaters who could cash in on the public's curiosity as long as they were willing to haggle with the censors, state by state. In these years, films like 1933's Narcotic and 1945's Mom and Dad dealt in very serious subject matter like drug addiction and unwed motherhood by striking a socially conservative posture. In 1936, The Lash of the Penitents combined documentary and fiction to showcase a cultish New Mexican Catholic sect who believed in salvation through self-flagellation. The film combined actual documentary footage of bizarre religious rituals with a corny murder mystery plot shot later. The big selling point for 1930s audiences would have been a brief scene of a nude woman hanging on a crucifix and being whipped.
But on and on they climbed toward their hills of Calvary, bearing their punishment bravely.
It is enough. Come, Felipe.
No one else shall have you but me.
No! Chico! Chico!
Chico!
Chico! Moving! No! No! No!
No!
Let go of me!
Oh, God. Give me strength.
In 1962, Mondo Cane updated the shockumentary for the post-war era and made it safe for middle-class audiences. It was beautifully shot in color, featured a sumptuous musical score, and most importantly, was undergirded with wry, ironic humor. It poked fun at middle-class audiences in a way that also, fundamentally, flattered them. Across its 108-minute running time, the film contrasts strange and grotesque practices, largely from the Eastern and Southern hemispheres, with odd fads in America and Europe, like modern art, or fancy Manhattan restaurants that serve bugs, or a Hollywood pet cemetery. Posing as an equal opportunity offender, Mondo Kane's thesis that we are all barbarians comes from a fundamentally racist perspective. It takes as granted that poor and/or largely non-white countries are barbaric, and the ironic point is that we are living down to them. This is the kind of racism that can go undetected in Western liberal circles, as evidenced by the fact that Mondo Kane played in competition at the 1962 Cannes Film Festival, side by side with Antonioni's L'Eclisse, Buñuel's The Exterminating Angel, and Varda's Cléo from 5 to 7, to name just three titles from a very strong lineup. It received largely positive reviews from the mainstream press, and its theme song, More, became an international chart topper and Oscar nominee, covered by no less than Frank Sinatra, who you heard earlier.
See the living dead. Stuff the goose until it explodes. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is it. Mondo Kane number one.
The directors of Mondo Kane and the unwitting architects of the whole Mondo genre were Gualtiero Jacopetti and Franco Prosperi. Jacopetti was and is the more famous of the duo, a flamboyant photojournalist of the swingin' 60s variety who is a fixture of the Italian tabloids for his interest in younger and often underage women. Born in Tuscany in 1919, Jacopetti participated in counter-espionage activities against Mussolini before becoming famous as a journalist, founding the short-lived but influential liberal magazine Cronache. Franco Prosperi came up through the film industry, working as a B-movie screenwriter and assistant to Mario Bava. Jacopetti pitched to Prosperi the idea of an anti-documentary, and in fairness to the liberal intelligentsia who greeted Mondo Kane warmly, it did have novelty on its side. Audiences in 1962 were unaccustomed to seeing a documentary with this kind of cinematic verve or sardonic humor.
All the scenes that you are about to see are real and were shot as they were taking place. If sometimes they seem cruel, it is only because cruelty abounds on this planet. And anyway, the duty of a reporter is not to make the truth seem sweeter, but to show things as they really are.
Mondo Kane also had a third credited director, Paolo Cavara. After falling out with Jacopetti, Cavara wrote a cinematic poison pen letter in the form of 1967's The Wild Eye. That film, a drama, is about a sadistic, unethical documentary filmmaker who travels Asia to capture human suffering. In the third act, he learns of a coming terrorist attack and makes plans to capture it from every angle.
If you shot the scene from here, you'd be perfectly safe. Yes. The shell will hit more or less where Barbara is sitting, and you'll be sheltered from the blast by this thick wall. You'll have plenty of time to get some good shots of the customers before the explosion.
But you're joking, aren't you?
No, I'm speaking perfectly seriously. I wouldn't miss this if it cost me my life.
You mean my life?
Because Mondo Kane was a documentary, its parade of erotic and/or disgusting imagery faced few threats of censorship. For American exploitation filmmakers, this offered a new loophole for getting sex, nudity, and extreme violence on screen in the 1960s. Jacopetti and Prosperi followed their triumph with two films in 1963, Mondo Kane 2 and Women of the World, both largely composed of outtakes from the original film. They showed everything from lesbian nightclubs to S&M dungeons to slave auctions to thalidomide babies to self-immolation. These films were financially successful, but bourgeois audiences were getting the message that they were not to be taken seriously. Other filmmakers co-opted the word Mondo to become a catch-all signifier for cinematic sensation. Russ Meyer's Mondo Topless was a pseudo-documentary look at strip clubs.
San Francisco, a teeming city of contrasts. Storied and snobbish edifices laying astride $10,000 a foot real estate, long steeped in the traditions of the staid upper crust, are now giving way to the new and pure. And San Franciscans are justifiably proud of their galloping architectural accomplishments. Soaring structures of chromium and plastic, melding the city's skyline into an Easter egg like you.
1964's Slave Trade in the World Today focused on just that, mostly in African countries. A slumming Vincent Price narrated Taboos of the World, while Boris Karloff lent his voice to Mondo Bellordo, which showed brothels and animal cruelty in Asia.
Authentic scenes of life in the raw, photographed in secret, shockingly revealed for the first time in Mondo Bellordo.
With so different, you won't believe it even after you've seen it.
Some of these films featured a mix of staged scenes and actual documentary footage. Others were entirely staged. In Mondo Bizarro and Mondo Freudo, the scenes of Middle Eastern slave markets are transparently shot in California. In 1969, an aspiring filmmaker from the suburbs of Baltimore named John Waters completed his first feature-length film, whose title was a self-aware play on the phenomenon, Mondo Trasho. Beyond the title, that movie's only overt nod to the Mondo genre occurred in its opening credits, which are set to footage of chickens being beheaded, much like in Mondo Cane. A scene that Waters now says he regrets, since the reference has been lost to time. The 60s Mondo boom may not deserve your respect, but it merits being remembered. If you squint a little, it's possible to place Mondo Cane and its imitators in a lineage of liberal ethnographic documentaries that both exoticize and condescend to their subjects, stretching as far back as 1915's In the Land of the Headhunters and 1922's Nanook of the North. That film, by Robert Flaherty, so long considered one of the founding pillars of the documentary genre, constructed an Inuit family's life for the camera that was much different and more primitive than the life they actually lived. It's also possible, perhaps, to position the Mondo films within a decade that saw so much experimentation with and debate about the limits of the documentary form. Peter Watkins' 1966 film The War Game was a speculative documentary based on data and expert study about what would happen if London were hit by an atomic bomb. Banned from the BBC, it won an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature, although it was entirely staged and dramatized and contained no actual documentary footage, quote-unquote. After the Mondo genre faded in Italy, its tropes continued to inform the country's exploitation films. Jacopetti and Prosperi's mingling of documentary and artifice led to such films as Cannibal Holocaust and Emmanuel in America, in which the scenes of unsimulated animal cruelty and explicit sex created a climate in which the extreme violence and simulated snuff seemed more real. In the United States, the Mondo films flourished across a decade in which courts were chipping away at obscenity laws. For instance, the 1967 Swedish film I Am Curious Yellow, about a young woman's search for political and sexual revolution, became a legal lightning rod for a scene in which a woman's mouth may or may not have grazed a man's penis. Lawyers were running the footage back and forth like the Zapruder film. Certain pioneering adult filmmakers of the late 60s and early 70s tested the boundaries of what was showable by including hardcore sex within a documentary context. A San Francisco filmmaker named Alex Dorenzi struck gold with such films as Censorship in Denmark and A History of the Blue Movie, although his 1970 film Animal Lover was banned after a short theatrical run, for reasons you can probably guess.
I don't like these movies.
Well, I mean, I didn't know that you'd feel that way about this movie. I don't know much about movies, but if I...
Is this the only kind of movies you go to?
Well, yeah, I mean, I come and this is not so bad.
Taking you to a place like this is about as exciting to me as saying, let's fuck.
This is today's Africa. A new Africa. An Africa you've never even imagined. Untouched jungles, wild tribes, and colonial mansions. That old Africa is dead. Africa, addio.
In 1966, Jacopetti and Prosperi returned with Africa, addio, their most ambitious and controversial movie yet. 3 years in the making, it chronicled the decolonization of Africa, a process that the filmmakers argue happened too fast. In one bloody scene after another, we see a continent overrun with poachers and warlords, genocides and civil war. Farms owned by white settlers are overrun by new black governments. Rare and endangered animals are killed without regulation.
No newspaper, no TV, no camera has dared to show the whole shocking reality of Africa today. Until now. Now, from the makers of Mondo Carne comes the searing truth of Africa today. The struggle for independence. Revolutions in Zanzibar, Angola, and Tanganyika. The story behind the apartheid in South Africa. The tragic civil war in the Congo.
The violence captured on screen is plainly real, but many wondered how much of what Jacopetti and Prosperi showed us was facilitated for the camera. In his zero-star review, Roger Ebert did a good job poking holes in its specific allegations and analyzing its imagery for traces of fraud. Ebert wrote, "Another suspicious scene shows poachers torturing an elephant to death. The early footage is shot at ground level. After we've seen enough suffering, the camera goes aloft, and we're told it's a helicopter flown by game wardens. In fact, it's the same helicopter used throughout the film. Was the scene staged, or did real poachers conveniently agree to star? It seems pretty clear that the elephant died for our entertainment. Later, we learn that it was pregnant." Elsewhere in his review, Ebert memorably proclaimed the film a brutal, dishonest, racist film. It slanders a continent and at the same time diminishes the human spirit, and it does so to entertain us. Even if Jacopetti and Prosperi were mere bystanders with cameras, the conclusions they draw from their footage are unmistakably reactionary. In a 2.5-hour film filled with executions and animal cruelty, no scene has lingered in my mind quite as unpleasantly as a scene depicting an oasis in the dark continent, a modern city where blonde, blue-eyed white people lounge by pools and jump on trampolines. This is Cape Town, South Africa. After a few minutes of this, Jacopetti and Prosperi violently cut to scenes of tribal rituals elsewhere to create an ugly juxtaposition. Africa Addio was widely seen, discussed, and even awarded in Italy, where it tied for best production at the Italian equivalent of the Oscars. But it also dealt a blow to the filmmakers' reputations from which they never recovered. During editing, the filmmakers were arrested by Italian police and charged with staging the execution of a Congolese rebel for the camera. They were able to produce documentation to show they happened to arrive at the scene before the shooting took place, but the stench followed them. In America, the film was shorn of 40 minutes, including most of its more lyrical passages, and released as Africa Blood and Guts to a mostly appalled critical reception.
From the white settlers to the black natives, guts were spilled. With blood, she gained her independence. With guts, she holds on to it.
For their part, Jacopetti and Prosperi were surprised by the negative reviews and responded with a movie that they thought would clear them of the charge of racism. Torquing the documentary format in a way similar to what Peter Watkins did with The War Game, their next movie was a reenactment of slavery in the American South in the antebellum era, presented as if filmed by an Italian documentary crew who had traveled back in time. It would become their professional Waterloo.
It was a time when humans were bought and sold like animals. A time of humiliation and horror. Of a hell created by man in the name of God.
1971's Goodbye, Uncle Tom is without question the most comprehensive and uncompromising cinematic depiction of the American slave trade in film history. To a fault. With its long stream of atrocities and humiliations performed by crowds of naked extras, it raises the question of at what point horror becomes sensationalism. It was also shot in Haiti under the brutal dictatorship of François Papadoc Duvalier with his full cooperation. Its parade of atrocities are performed by impoverished extras who had little agency over their participation. It says something about Jacopetti and Prosperi's worldview that they were participating in at least some of what they were condemning. The film was poorly received. Roger Ebert called it the most disgusting, contemptuous insult to decency ever to masquerade as a documentary. In The New Yorker, Pauline Kael called it the most specific and rabid incitement to race war. She was referring to the film's stunning epilogue, which takes place in modern-day America and draws a straight line from the pre-Civil War era to the present day, and appears to obliquely call for black viewers to take up arms. Theater owners in Times Square agreed with Cale that the film was too hot to handle and pulled it from exhibition in less than a week. Ever since Mondo Cane, a key appeal of the Mondo genre had been its willingness to show the unshowable. As nudity and sex became normalized on screen, that left one more taboo for the genre to exploit. Death.
In one brief moment, within the span of a heartbeat, your world could stop. There is no way to predict when you will become one of them. For the first time in cinema history, the greatest fear of all mankind will be graphically exposed.
The selling point of 1978's Faces of Death was that it contained footage of real death. In classic Mondo style, it opens with a doctor, one Francis B. Gross, a pathologist who tells us that he has spent his career collecting footage of death to better understand it. How exactly all this footage of executions would help him, I don't know. Faces of Death is clumsy, boring, and, if you were a certain kind of adolescent at a sleepover party in the 1980s, irresistible. Irresistible, that is, until they saw the film, so much of which was transparently fake. Needless to say, that doctor was just an actor.
But over the past 20 years, I've compiled a library of the many faces of death. My travels have taken me all over the world, searching for the various situations that have dealt with our ultimate end. I've seen with my own eyes a myriad of experiences that have led me to a greater awareness of the living. We have developed a world that refuses to recognize our own destiny.
Still, the film had plenty of disgusting and authentic archival footage of dead bodies, animal violence, assassination and war, and scenes of open-heart surgery, prominently figured in the trailer, which I don't recommend looking up. Faces of Death was an American production aimed specifically at the Japanese market, but it became a hit all over the world, especially on video, where it became something of a boogeyman for parents and conservative lawmakers. In the UK, it was one of the tapes prosecuted in the infamous Video Nasties purge that followed the passage of the Video Recordings Act of 1984. In 2003, a version of the film passed UK censors with 2 minutes and 19 seconds cut. The United States saw no similar legislation, but the Video Nasty phenomenon did catch the attention of Siskel and Ebert.
But beyond that is the sickness and shoddiness of this entire film. This is more than just a Halloween party gag. It is truly disgusting and badly made. And of course, the issue which we'll deal with later is the easy access kids have to this material in many video stores.
In the case of a whole lot of these things, and I also looked at Faces of Death Part 2 and Faces of Death Part 3, but what bothered me more was the way these films dwell on human despair in an almost sadistic and almost gleeful way. The actual subject matter of many of these ways of death didn't bother me nearly as much as the fact that the film seems to feel nothing about it.
Well, they're not wrong about Faces of Death. There's not much artistic merit to it, and don't think I haven't gone looking. That said, I'm not sure if it was quite as harmful as they made it out to be. After all, who isn't curious about death? Who doesn't want to know, even a little bit, what it looks like? Did any of you watch this movie at a sleepover party in the 80s? How did you turn out? Phones are open.
The mysterious and puzzling world of the Far East, as it has never been shown before. All waiting for you in an exciting, incredible motion picture documentary. Shocking Asia, a breathtaking journey through a continent of miracles and mysteries.
Later Mondo movies were sold as endurance tests for the most jaded curiosity seekers. Mondo Magic, about tribes in Africa and South America who believe in magic, hit new heights in depicting animal cruelty. Shocking Asia, filmed mostly in 1974, became a hit on 42nd Street in the 80s for its explicit depiction of gender-affirming surgery. The genre more or less ended with 1989's cheeky Mondo New York, which I would recommend. It's a self-aware spin on the genre that mixes Mondo tropes with performances by such underground artists of the era as Lydia Lunch and Karen Finley.
Mondo, New York, home to outcast, misfit, reject, loser, pervert, lunatics, gangsters, pranksters, and outlaws, yeah, neurotic, psychotic, maniacs, Nerds, brainiacs, hippies, yippies, yuppie, junkies, flunkies, monkeys, yeah.
Faces of Death spawned six sequels and countless imitators, and its influence can be felt on everything from the Jerry Springer Too Hot for Television videos of the 90s to Rotten.com. Its success made possible at least one more movie that's worth your time, another American film aimed at the Japanese market, The Killing of America from 1981. Written by Paul Schrader's brother Leonard, this grueling film chronicles American gun violence and assassinations from approximately the shootings of JFK to John Lennon, who was killed during production.
America the Beautiful has become America the Violent. This is the country that produces an attempted murder every 3 minutes, a murder victim every 20 minutes, 27,000 murders a year, and the number is growing. No one is safe.
Accumulating one act of violence after another, this relentlessly despairing film calls for strict gun control while also pondering if there's something inherently violent about the American condition. Its dual thesis, in fact, is not far from that of Bowling for Columbine, a movie not entirely removed from the Mondo tradition. But The Killing of America has none of Michael Moore's mischief. It's a howl of anguish. If you watch only one Mondo movie, make it this one. Thanks for joining me on this journey.
Fish out of water, now what can I do? Fish out of water, my face is so out of water, I'll scream, then I'll cry. Fish out of water, it's your tattoo night.
You got me going now.
I'm on the beat.
You know there's something wrong.
Now beat.
You see how easy now.